This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches. In today's interview, I'm going to be talking to Laure Sabourin, who is a professional climber and training leader at the Warriors Way and also a rock guide. They climbed up to 514 on trad, including loads of pretty scary 513s as well, and also been an unwavering advocate of transparency and dialogue around the non-binary and trans community in climbing. I first got to know Laure through my trad climbing in the USA. We're both fans of the occasional bit of crack climbing, and then further through some coaching and training plan work that we did with them at Lattice. Since then, Laure has gone on to continually crush on both an outdoor climbing and professional career level, the second of which is where I really want to take today's interview, as the work that they're doing at the Warriors Way is super interesting and valuable for pretty much any climber. Laure delivers programs that aim to build resilient, flexible minds that are equipped to deal with stress, anxiety, and fear, something that comes up in both climbing experiences and in everyday life. Whilst I think a lot of us understand that these things, or what these things mean, we haven't necessarily developed the tools or the strategies to make changes in them. In this podcast, we're going to be talking about these topics and also boundary setting, mindfulness, and self-image. Welcome to the podcast, Laure.
Oh, thanks, Tom. I'm so excited to be here.
It's been a little while since we chatted last. It was probably most people are thinking it's since we last did a podcast like a year and a half ago or so, but actually we last saw each other in a desert car park, didn't we?
Totally. Yeah, right outside of Moab in the BLM land camping.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for anyone who's listening who either hasn't listened to your first podcast or isn't aware of the work that you do with the Warriors Way, could you just give a little bit of a background into your entry into that type of work, and then also just share a little bit about your personal journey with mental coaching, if you wouldn't mind?
Yeah, of course. So I first became aware of the Warriors Way as a younger climber. I was a comp climber when I was a teenager and was really in a place where I was unsure whether I could continue to climb because I was experiencing so much fear in my climbing. And the paradigm at the time, and I think honestly still now in so many places, is you just need to take giant falls and get it over with. And I would just go up on the wall and freeze. Like I'd be up there for an hour hanging on. I have great endurance because of it. I have a great base of being able to hang on the wall now. But it got to the point where I just felt so discouraged and I didn't really know if rock climbing was even a place for me, because the tools that I was given for my mental training really didn't feel accessible to me. It felt like there was some kind of secret code that I hadn't cracked. And I loved climbing, but I was so stuck that I was not really able to progress anymore. And then when I first found the Warriors Way techniques, it was through a friend at the gym who was kind of a mentor of mine. And he came in one session and he was planning to do a training session. And he just saw me like once again, frozen on the wall. And he's just like, come over here. And he started teaching me a little bit about incremental falling. And he had gotten that material from the Warriors Way book. And he loaned me the book to read. He was just like, Laure, you need to, you're doing it all wrong. Like you're taking such a painful approach to this. Like it doesn't have to be so hard. And so that was my first exposure to the material. And really at the time for me, it was just about practice falling, right? Like that was the only thing that I had learned from the material. But as I was starting to read the book, I realized that there was a lot more to it. And that was a time, my late teens and my early 20s was a very formative time for me with exploring identity. It was also a time that I was in recovery from addiction. And I was really like looking for something that I needed out of climbing and that I wasn't getting just out of like going rock climbing all the time and trying to send harder and harder things. So taking a different approach to climbing was so important to me. And the Warriors Way material was something that I kept kind of coming back to. And And I think finding ways to apply it to my own life that maybe hadn't even been intended in the book. And so it really became something personal for me. When I was in my mid-20s, I was coaching at the gym and I was doing a lot of physical training and technique coaching, and just realizing that so many of the people that I was working with had mental limitations rather than physical or technique limitations. And I wanted to be able to share the material with them. I wanted to do that in an ethical way. I didn't want to just start teaching what I had learned from the book because I had read it somewhere. And so I reached out to Arno, who runs the Warrior's Way, and asked him what it would look like to get training in the material. And that turned into a really cool apprenticeship and mentorship relationship with him. I became a trainer for the Warrior's Way through that process and started teaching just the basic falling in commitment clinics for them, and was just so, I think, was always so psyched about how to take everything further, right? I was like having these conversations with the athletes I was working with, and it was just so obvious that people were so hungry for the material beyond just falling, right? They were making all these connections just like I had, and I wanted to be able to continue to provide that for them and even expand what we were able to offer. And so worked closely with Arno and another of our trainers, Jeff, to expand the programming to be more comprehensive mental training beyond just how do I fall if I'm afraid to fall. And so it's been a really cool journey for me, and it's been both a career journey and also a passion project, and also always a process of applying it to my own climbing and experimenting there.
Yeah. I've personally found it fascinating watching your change as a climber from, you know, the outside, and the way that you've so thoughtfully applied the things that you've learned from, I suppose, what we would class as being a technical or sort of academic or sort of theory-based side of things, but then finding really meaningful ways of bringing that back into climbing, whether it's into your own climbing or with people that you work with. And that's a concept that always really fascinates me as a coach, because I love this blend of theory and idea and good practice and evidence-based practice that then comes back into actually just a workable, practical solution that loads and loads of people can actually get their hands on, not just a scientific paper or a journal that you read in Men's Health or whatever it might be, you know, or like an article that you read in a magazine. It's practical stuff that you can do something with. And I think that's fantastic. And could you just sort of give me a brief overview of exactly what kind of encapsulates the approach that Warrior's Way takes with mental coaching in a sort of broad umbrella?
Yeah. And I think first responding to what you said, right, it's like, it would be awesome. I think maybe that's not the right way to start it even. It's thinking about like that transition from intellectual to tangible and experiential. And I think that's when people are looking for these approaches. It's like, that's the same with physical training. Someone doesn't want to hire a coach and have them send them 50 pages of research papers to read, right? They want a training plan that they can apply to their climbing. And I think that can be really tricky in mental training. Oftentimes, you know, we give someone this theoretical knowledge and we don't back it up with something they can do tangibly in their climbing. And then it feels really inaccessible. And they're like, oh, that's really nice. I understand it in theory, but I can't apply it. And so that's so important. I think the mental training approach that the Warrior's Way takes and that I take, I often call it like mental flexibility or mental agility training. And I'm contrasting that with mental toughness, right? Which is an approach that a lot of athletes take, and it can apply really well to certain sports, but not necessarily as well to climbing. And so explaining the difference, you know, in mental toughness, we're looking at a certain amount of stress and we're trying to prepare for it, right? And mental toughness doesn't just necessarily mean like putting on armor and getting like super tough, but it can be things like power of positive thinking, right? And I was a runner before I was a climber, and power of positive thinking can actually be really awesome for running, because it's a very rhythmic, repetitive movement. You don't have to respond a lot to too much changing stimulus. You know, I mean, obviously there's differences in terrain. I was a cross country runner. I've also done a lot of trail running. So like, you need to be aware of your surroundings, but ultimately the complexity of the movement is way simpler than climbing. Right. And so power of positive thinking, or like psyching ourselves up for a challenge, can be really helpful. And that can be helpful on the ground in climbing. But if in the middle of your rock climb, when you're on your hardest moves, you're thinking about sending and you're like trying to psych yourself up while you're also trying to execute a crux, you're using half of the mental energy that you should be using to focus attention on your climbing on this other, this piece of mental toughness. The other issue is with mental toughness, you're trying to get to a certain level of stress that you can manage. And in climbing, we're always, the stress level is always changing and the situation is always changing. So when I think of mental agility and the goal there, it's developing a mind that allows attention to flow freely as the situation changes, including as the stress level increases or decreases, and not feeling like we have to have a sense of control over the situation, but feeling like we have the resources internally to deal with this situation and to really blend with it, rather than feeling like we're fighting against the stressors of the situation.
Yeah, it's like that sort of, I suppose, in a way, that's sort of like a concept of sort of flowing with the water and not trying to push it out, and understanding that the water will constantly move and it's like a sort of sinuous item and you can't entirely predict it. You can see sort of direction and you know the feel and the material of it, but you have to kind of move with it if you want to have a great, productive, you know, sort of efficient experience within that.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Carl Jung uses the analogy of the river of life, right? And I'll like bring that up kind of tongue in cheek with my athletes. Sometimes we'll joke about like being in the river of life and like clinging to the grass on the banks, like trying not to have to go down the next rapid. And how much energy that takes, right? Rather than when we're on a climb and we're flowing with it, we're allowing, in a way, we're allowing ourselves to be moved by the water that we're in. And we're also, we're not resisting it, but we're also able to keep swimming, right? We're able to stay afloat in that situation when we feel like we have the resources we need.
How do you tend to tackle the concepts of controllable and uncontrollable factors within climbers? And I ask this because I think this is probably one of the most common things that comes up when I'm trying to kind of specifically work in that sort of a mentoring relationship with someone, how they actually like perform right at the end. They've sorted all their training out. They've got all these sort of technical things out, but like dealing with controllable versus uncontrollable. How do you work with that? Or how do you define it for people?
Yeah. Often what I'll talk to people about, I have a few points when we talk about control and what we can and can't control. And what I'll go back to is we can control what we're focusing on. We can control what we're paying attention to. We can't necessarily control our external environment, but even internally, we can't control the thoughts that come up firsthand or the emotions that come up inside of us, right? Those things happen beyond a level of conscious control. So the thing that we can control is how we pay attention to them, right? And where we're actually directing our attention. So I think of that attention as the source of our personal power, right? And so when we're, a really simple example, I go back to falling, because falling is one of the easiest drills we do in mental training, is that in falling, we teach athletes to focus on specific points of body awareness. That can be their breathing, where they're looking, and what they're doing with their body, right? And I'll often debrief that with climbers, and I'll say, you know, there's a lot of things we can't control when we're falling. We can't control how much slack our belayer has given us. We can't control whether they're going to jump or not. We can't, like, we definitely can't control whether there's a ledge or not once we're already in the air. You know, those things aren't going to change. But we can control what we do with our body, and that makes a huge difference. Because if I'm really tense and I'm holding my breath and I'm squeezing my eyes shut and there is a bulge there, I'm going to slam into it and probably get hurt. You know, if I'm relaxed, if I'm exhaling, if I'm looking at it, I might just be able to push off of it and not get hurt. You know, and so the things that we can control, they don't completely change the situation, but they change the way we interact with it. So that's an example from falling, but I work with climbers to change the way that they focus attention around when they're actually on the wall, when they're climbing. We work on directing attention into the body during the actual climbing task. So when you're doing hard moves, how do you keep your attention engaged in your body rather than get distracted by thinking? I do a lot of work with people on intentional thinking processes. So on the wall, focusing on gathering the information that they need to make a risk decision rather than just like stopping and letting their mind wander wherever it wants to go. And then off the wall, we do a lot of work on when I'm having big emotions, when, you know, a lot of anxiety is coming up. Maybe I'm feeling anxiety about getting afraid, which is a really common one that can happen days before a rock climb. Or I'm having anxiety about how a trip's going to go, if I'm going to be able to get on the maybe last season I had like this amazing breakout season and now I'm going back and, you know, it's 3 weeks away, but I'm already like getting sick to my stomach just thinking about, am I going to be able to match or exceed my performance from the year before? And so I really work with athletes to focus attention in specific ways when those thoughts or emotions are coming up so that they're able to engage with them from an empowered place rather than feeling just completely like dragged in all directions by their thoughts and emotions that come up.
And do you think a lot of that really is about giving people tools that they understand and grasp and when to use them in whatever situation it is? So you're like sort of giving them a quiver of arrows and saying, here, this is my, you know, this is the thing that you can go and use. You don't quite know which one you're going to use in which situation until you practice it and you work out which one works best where. Is it that kind of approach that you take with it?
Yeah, I definitely have some tried and true drills and tools that we'll use. And we practice those. And at first people can feel like, okay, what are we doing here? Because we'll practice it in low stress situations. And so, you know, I might have someone do a body awareness drill to be able to notice when, like the levels of tension that they're feeling in their body throughout the day. And at first someone's like, this is kind of funny. Like, I don't know what's going on. And then suddenly they're in a situation that brings up stress and they're like, whoa, I was able to notice my like stress level increasing before I got into a place where I was panicking. And so I was able to attend to that using maybe some other skill sets that we had worked on. And they like are implementing these skills in real time. And so a lot of it is drilling things in low stress situations so that in a higher stress situation, someone can take those pieces that they've practiced and they already have, you know, I think a lot about neural networking, like developing the pathways that people need so that they don't have to sit there and like go back through a book when they're in a high stress situation and try and remember what to do. It's like, I want to drill it with them to the point where when they are in a situation, the first thing that comes to mind for them is this new way of interacting, is this new way of focusing attention.
And what's your feeling in terms of, I suppose, duration or consistency that someone should put in before it starts to become that sort of automative, you know, you don't even have to think about it. It's just straight away you have that type of behavior in response to whatever situation. And I know there is no like everyone's unique and different. But for those listening, should I guess I'm asking how much patience should people give themselves on these particular items?
Those, when I think about mental training, like the words that always come to mind for me are curiosity and patience. And like even just that piece of like not feeling like you need to have it perfect or having compassion for yourself, having the ability to like not get it right all the time or not have it be immediate is one of the things that we practice in itself. Because as soon as we get like, we want to have it all figured out, as soon as we want to like have these neural networks like wired to the point where we never have to like think about them, we kind of self-sabotage, because then all of a sudden we're thinking about whether we're doing it right. And so there's two answers to that. Like, one is, you know, a lot of times athletes, like as soon as they start working through these things, I find, you know, I'm really interested in this idea of organic intelligence. The area that I'm studying in school around trauma therapy is somatic experiencing and body-oriented psychotherapy. And so it's really looking at, like, our body knows how to heal if we get out of the way, right? And our body naturally moves towards healing. And so if we give our body an adaptive tool that feels good, it's going to like try and replicate it as much as possible. Right. And so that when I often have athletes that like, we'll work together and the first week, they like are making all these connections. And I think that even happens in physical training. Like someone reaches out and you give them, and they've like done one hangboard workout, and all of a sudden they send their project the first time because they're so excited and like so amped up, and they're making connections and doing things that they never would have done before. They're like, man, that hangboard workout works so well. And you're like, well, not actually, but like, just stick with it. This is awesome that you're so psyched. And obviously when someone's been training for a long time, that usually doesn't happen anymore. It's more like when someone first starts training, maybe all they needed was that belief that they could do it. And so when someone first starts mental training, a lot of times they're making these connections so quickly and they're so excited about it that things start changing really quickly. And then the flip side of that answer is like, it could take a lifetime, right? To like fully embody these things. And it's, I'm still in a process of, I have all these tools and sometimes they're immediate. And sometimes I go back and I'm like, oh man, I really wish I had used that tool on this like hard conversation or on that rock climb when I just got frustrated, you know? And I think a lot of times when I'm working with athletes, I see this sweet spot happen after about 2 to 3 months where they're really starting to make these connections. And it's almost like I switch from being kind of a teacher, instructor, like providing them with the tools, to I'm almost like there as a witness, support, advocate for like keeping that work going. Because all of a sudden they start, like everything starts connecting for them in these really powerful ways.
Yeah, I think, with the mental work that you often do as an athlete or a climber, is that it's very much like physical training in the sense that it can be like a really unrefined, blunt process until you've like learned what it feels like. And the more that you practice it over the years, you go, ah, that's what that feels like to do that thing. And you become more reflective and understanding your own mind and your own body and that mind-body connection you get with it. So that, and I always want to like remind people that have trust in this work, because year after year after year of doing it, you get better and better and more expert in it, in the same way that you look at a very experienced, and I'm gonna make this super simple, like very experienced high-level climber who they know the exact warm-up to do to get the best possible fingerboard score. They just know their fingers very, very well and what it takes to get into just the right way. Someone who has been through a very good process of mental coaching or mental self-exploration knows themselves and their process very, very well. I guess I can see you nodding your head, like agreeing in this.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking of some of my most experienced athletes that I've worked with for the longest time. And I mean, I'm just blown away by the ways that they'll come back and say, like, yeah, I was in this really hard situation. And then, you know, in the moment, I just had this like this intuitive sense of like how to live by my values in this situation. And I like grounded myself in that. And I like took a deep breath and rolled my shoulders over it, like back. And then I like did the hard thing and it felt, and I'm just listening to them and I'm like, oh, I should be learning from you. Like there's so much depth there when someone's, you know, just the pieces there of saying like, I'm living by my values. I'm listening to my intuition. I'm taking that next hard step. I'm relying on my body and finding safety there. And when someone walks me through that, but they're walking me through something that they did in 15 seconds, it really humbles me to think about how powerful it can be to invest that deeply in understanding your mental space, which, you know, it's not just your thinking, it's like your relationship with your entire body, with your nervous system, with your intuition. And it's really powerful when people are in that process where they're continuously doing that work. It does become something where, like you said, in the beginning, there's a lot of like thinking and learning, and it feels kind of messy and confusing. And then you listen to someone who's years down the road, and it is such an intuitive process for them.
And what part does written reflections play in this process for time? Because I know you've talked about, you know, sort of like drills and exercises that you can do, but I know that you take this approach as well with written reflections. How does that, what does that piece in the puzzle, where does it fit in?
Yeah, I find, and you know, I think there's diversity in how people express that, but I usually encourage my athletes to either write, voice record, or draw. And that just leaves space for neurodiversity, right? Because some people, they go to sit down and write and they're just like, it's not the way that they process. But I encourage all of my athletes, like after a session and also as they're practicing these drills, to keep some kind of record. So written reflection is the most common. And I think what it does is it helps someone externalize their process, so they're able to see it in a really powerful way. When I'm coaching, it's so helpful because I might be on a call with someone once a week, or I might have, you know, I run groups, so I might have a group for, like, I meet with them once a week, right? So the actual interaction time I get with them on those calls, in those spaces, they've like set aside the time to be on a call. They're not climbing, they're not in the stress of it. So it's their experience of it isn't, it's in such a low stress environment that it's so helpful for them to do that reflection when they're in it, or like right after they're in it, because I get totally different information on a call versus in their journals that we share. So I can give really different feedback. And then I think the most powerful aspect of that is when we keep those written reflections over time. And this is something that I've seen that's been really powerful in my own training logs, is I've kept narrative training logs since I was 12 or 13 years old. And I have them all. And so I can go back and look at what did 12-year-old Laura think about their training session, not just like, you know, I mean, because the actual content of my 12-year-old training sessions is like, I'm not going to replicate that in any way, but it's given me so much insight, you know, to have almost 18 years of reflection on what I've done as an athlete and how that's shaped me as a person, and how these different things that I've been through in my training and also my external life have influenced me. I've really seen this thread, and it's just taught me so much more about what approach to take in my own training and in my own approach to climbing. I think it kind of completes the loop in a way. Like, we go out, we practice, we apply, but if we don't give ourselves that written feedback at the end, if we don't see ourselves externalize it, we often don't have a full picture of what's going on.
That's interesting. That I'm really bad at it. I don't really record anything at all. And I like listening to, you know, either audiobooks or reading articles or different experts in the field around, you know, mental coaching, mindset, performance psychology. And they all, you know, this is a particular practice that lots of people talk about as being a really good thing. But I have always personally struggled with it. And I'm not entirely sure why. So if I was, and I think some people listening will be in this same situation, struggling with this part of the process, how do you pitch it to them as being a worthwhile thing to do, especially in nowadays, in quite a time restricted world? We're all think we're really busy, we're all bossed with lots of things for our attention. How do you sort of do that persuasion thing?
I think there can be a few pieces with that. The thing that I don't do is I don't try to like sell them on how important it is, because I think that almost all of my athletes want to do it and they understand why it's important. And I'll even have athletes like reach out and apologize for not writing enough, or they're like, I was bad this week, I didn't fill out my journal or something. And I think that piece, it's not a matter of telling someone it's important, right? But it's a matter of creating, like we can go into just basic habit science and we can say, you know, if I really do value it, and it's not happening, but it's something I really want, then am I trying to make it too big, right? Like, am I trying to say, like, I need to sit down after every session and write out like a 3 paragraphs about my training session, or I need to sit down every night and write out like this huge reflection on my climbing? And you know, in habit science, that's just not going to work because we've created a task that's too big. And it's kind of the equivalent of telling someone who's terrified of falling to go take a big whip, right? It's like it's not going to happen. And so when I'm working with athletes, sometimes it'll be looking at, you know, what's the smallest step? What feels almost stupid? You know, can you give yourself just at the top of your training log that day, can you write in like, I'm feeling, and finish the sentence, you know? And it doesn't have to be an emotion. It can be like, I'm feeling sick and tired of these types of sessions. I hate endurance. Or it can be funny, or like you can draw a face, you know, but that could be, it's cool to look back at those because you actually look back through and you can see a year of like, I'm feeling this way during a session. That's a lot of information about your sessions and what you're experiencing. You can like doodle on the side of your training log if you keep a written training log. And if it's on your phone, it might just be recording, you know, 10, 15 second voice memo at the end. You're like, wrapping up, this is my one sentence on how I think it went. You know, and I think it can be a matter of like just playing with your own ability in your own time frame and using something that's realistic. And it's also you have to want to do it though too, right? Like I think we can get in that mindset of thinking that it's good or like that we should do it, but we don't really know why we want to do it. And so, you know, for years I was like, oh, I should really have a flexibility routine, and I didn't, and I just kept saying I should, but I hadn't really thought about why I should, you know, because I was pretty flexible already. And I ended up having, when I finally carved one out, it was because I was having these really busy mornings, and stretching in the morning became the time that I set aside for myself before launching into my day. And it felt so nourishing to just have that time in my day that I set aside for myself, and I listened to a podcast for 10 minutes before I launched into my day. And now I like look forward to it so much. And it was my why became setting aside time for myself and showing myself that I was worth 10 minutes of stretching in the morning. And that's a totally different reason than me just thinking like I should stretch. So having something like that. And the last piece for my athletes is I respond to them. So it becomes like a little pen pal situation kind of. And I think honestly, that is sometimes the most fun for them, is like having, I think coaching is a real relationship, right? It's two people. We often think just about like the athletes getting this product of a training plan, but we as humans, like we're looking for relationships. Right. And so when I'm coaching, I really think about like I like influence my athletes, they influence me, and I love interacting with them. And so the journal or having some kind of reflection like that is a back and forth. And I think if you can have that as an athlete that does have a coach, that you're getting that support, that can be a really valuable incentive, is just that back and forth communication.
Mm. And how do you think that as climbers we, and I know this is something that you do actively when you work with people, is try to build or allow for people to become more resilient as climbers, humans. How do you do that? Because I think a lot of people go, that sounds great, but like, how do you actually do that? Am I born that way? Can I change it? So how do you view resilience, and what can you do to change, or what can people do to change?
Yeah, I think of resilience as our ability to not just tolerate stress, but show up well in stress. And it's really all about our relationship with stress, right? And oftentimes when we hear the word stress, like, we immediately have a negative connotation about it, right? We're like, stress is bad. I want to avoid stress at all costs. Or, you know, Tom, if we started this podcast today, I'm like, how are you doing? And you're like, you know, I've just had a really stressful week. I would, you know, I'd probably respond like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, that sounds really bad. You know, I would feel like, oh, that means that you're not thriving. Mm. Right. And then we have this climbing, like our sport of climbing, that requires us to take on stress, and we actively choose to do it. But we bring in this attitude of wanting it to be not stressful, and those things clash so aggressively. And we see it all the time, right? And I think we see it a lot in training, and in physical and mental training. What people often aren't saying, but they're kind of, it's read between the lines, is, I want you to get me stronger so that rock climbing doesn't feel hard anymore, right? Like, or at least the grades that I want to climb, they don't feel hard anymore. Like, I want to float up them. I want it to feel effortless. And I think as coaches, we often have to like reimagine that headspace with our athletes, of saying like, we can get you stronger, but we're also going to need to get you to a point where like, you're willing to try hard, and you're willing in that space to experience the discomfort of something feeling too hard, or even like having that impression of being impossible. So climbing is such an amazing sport for developing resilience, because we have this really obvious stressful stimulus that we're also so inspired to interact with. And I think if we can reframe someone's relationship with stress, that carries into every aspect of their life. Because we also live in a world that, despite all of the comforts that we have, is inherently stressful. And I think that a lot of people in the last few years have been experiencing that to an even greater degree than before. You know, and I think if we're still living in a paradigm where we're saying like, this shouldn't be happening, this shouldn't be so hard, that I'm not saying that we have to get to a place where we're saying all of this happens for a reason, or I'm like so happy that this is happening, right? This is really real suffering we're talking about. We're mm-hmm. not saying this is like, it should be happening, but getting someone to the point where they're saying like, yeah, this is really hard, and I'm going to look for the tools to deal with this rather than just feeling completely crushed by it, is what I think about when I'm teaching resiliency tools. And so, you know, it ranges for, you know, resiliency tools. That's like, in some ways, that's all of mental training. Like, that's what I'm doing from day one with an athlete. But I think when I think of what really allows us to be resilient, I think of being able to establish a sense of safety in our body. A lot of athletes find it odd that I always start mental training, no matter who I'm working with. If they're an elite athlete, if they're a beginning rock climber, we always start with body awareness and the ability to regulate our nervous system. And they like want to go into like kind of advanced thinking drills, and they're really into like, but I'm having these limiting thoughts. Why are you making me pay attention to my breathing? I know how to breathe. And I want to know that someone can feel safe in their body before I send them out into a stressful situation. And I want them to be able to know when an amount of stress feels like something they can deal with, versus when they're going to go off the deep end, when they're going to go into the panic zone, and they're not going to be able to get back without some kind of micro injury, stress injury. So when I'm working with athletes, like the first thing I go to is, do you know what it feels like to feel safe in your body? Do you know what an appropriate level of stress is for you? And can you get back to a safe place using body regulation techniques, right? So things like breathing, orientation to your space, that's a huge resilience tool, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think like we can layer onto that our perspective on stress and really our the way that we attach our identity to the outcomes we produce, the ways that we feel supported by our communities and we feel able to interact with them. So there's all these layers and it all kind of is connected by this thread of how do we view stress and how do we see our ability, like what do we see as our ability to find resources when we're experiencing a lot of stress?
Mm. Yeah, it's, I think it's with that kind of stress factor as well as it's, I always feel it's intrinsically tied in with this whole concept of controllable and uncontrollables as well. And often a lot of our stress can be around the uncontrollables. And it's such a, I don't want to say life affirming, but it's such a positive thing that when you can go through your first process of going, I've got this really uncontrollable and really stressful thing that previously was totally stressful, I can just look at that item now and go, okay, it is what it is, but you know what? I'm okay with that item. I now have the tools set up. I can feel even positively motivated by this, what was previously a stressful situation. And for me personally, I then developed a self-belief that that was possible to deploy into other areas. Once you've done it once and you've practiced it enough, and sometimes it can be a really simple thing in your life where you go, oh, is that really worthwhile practicing that thing through to its endpoint? But I promise you, anyone listening, do it in something very simple and achieve it and master it, and you will go, huh, you can put it into other areas.
Yeah, as you were talking, I had this like really vivid memory of being 17-year-old and had just experienced a lot of traumatic stress in my life. And so when we're talking about this, right, we're not saying that like stress is always a good thing, right? But it's like sometimes stress is just a part of what we experience. And I had specifically experienced a lot of really intense stressors. And one of the resources that I had had taken away from me at that point was my ability to be an athlete, because I had just had a series of hip surgeries at that age. And so I was really just in this place where I was like looking around me for any resources I could get. And I was coming up dry, you know, and a climbing coach of mine actually like took me out in behind the climbing gym and taught me how to make a Bodrill fire. So like just like set me up with like, you know, taught me how to make it like from scratch. Like he gave me a log and he was like, we're going to make fires. We're going to just like sit back here and learn how to make fires with our hands. Right. And a knife. And it was like, at that time I needed a resource of seeing when you were talking about these simple things, like I needed something that engaged me so intensely and that was so hard, but it was external to me. It wasn't involved in any of these other stressors that were going on in my life. It felt like low stakes. And I was out there for weeks trying to do it. And I remember like making my first fire and like setting something on fire and just feeling like, oh, I just did a thing, right? And it completely changed the trajectory of my recovery at the time from that injury. It changed the trajectory of how I was looking at all of the stress that I was experiencing in my life, and this feeling of going from just feeling like so bad for myself to feeling like, oh, I actually like, maybe I'm not looking for resources, the resources that I need. Right. And I never want to put that on someone else to say like, it's your job to go find your resources, because we should have communities that provide those resources. And I think that taking something through to completion, whether it's a climbing project, whether it's a training plan, whether it's something completely outside of climbing, it does, like you were saying, it's almost like casting a vote in the direction of like, I'm a person that can deal with things that are stressful in my life. And if that's all I give to my athletes, like my job's done, right? I think if they believe that they're a person who can deal with stress, that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah. And just that point of where you cross over that threshold and you go, I am someone who can deal with stress or a stress, is such an important part of self-belief, because then it allows you or empowers you then to go, well, maybe I'll tackle the other thing over there that I wasn't quite ready for, but yeah, you know what? I'm going to have a go. And it just like, it starts to snowball and builds from there. Got another question. Where do you think is the importance of setting boundaries? And how does this fit in with performance and mental coaching and the work that you do?
Yeah. I love the topic of boundaries. And I actually have my advisor in school and someone that I just, one of my heroes in life, like she talks about boundaries and she talks about the difference between limits and boundaries. And I think that's somewhere where as climbers, we can get confused, is that limits are like our absolute safety limits, right? So there are things that we set in our lives to protect our safety. We never cross them. We try not to get close to them, right? So like a limit for me would be like, I want my belayer to have their hand on the brake rope, right? And I'm probably not going to be like going out climbing with someone who's not using proper belay technique. Or, you know, someone else might have a limit, and this shows like our limits can be personal, right? But someone might have a limit that they don't solo, right? And like, and they're just, that's not going to be how they approach their climbing. So those are things that are really hard and fast, and they don't change. They can be more rigid. I think of boundaries as the parameters that we put around our learning to protect our joy and our ability to show up well in that space and continue to learn. And so when I think about boundaries, it's like I set boundaries so that I'm able to interact with the stressors that I want to take on in a way that feels nourishing and not depleting, right? And when I set a boundary, it has to be personal, because someone else might have completely different boundaries that allow them to get so much joy and fulfillment out of a situation. And if I use their boundaries, I wouldn't be able to show up well. I would be spending my whole day feeling scared, wishing that the day was over with, just feeling like relieved when it is done and being like, I'm so glad I got done with that, right? And we've all had climbing experiences like that where like we top out and we just want to like kiss the ground. We're like, I am so glad that this is done with, right? I'm so like, we grab the chains at the end and we're just like, I'm so thankful for clipping the chains. And it's because we're glad it's over. And if you think about, if you spend your whole climbing career that way and you always want it to be over with, it's like, ultimately it will be over with. Like there will be a rock climb that's your last rock climb, and then you won't get to rock climb anymore. And it's like, we don't want to be in a rush to get there, right? We want to enjoy every moment of it. And so when we set boundaries, we're able to stay engaged. And I spend a lot of time talking to my athletes about boundaries, and I'll call, you know, we use the terms setting boundaries and setting risk decisions or making risk decisions sometimes interchangeably, because I like to show people that when we're making these decisions about our boundaries, even if it's not the risk that we're considering isn't hitting the ground, that the risks are real that we're considering, and we have to be willing to interact with the consequences of our decisions. And so, you know, a boundary can be as simple as setting a yes or no fall line. Like up to this point, I'm going to stay 100% committed to climbing. If I fall off, I can fall off because I know that I can fall there well, that if I fall, it's not going to create a little micro trauma for me. And in a no fall zone, I'm going to allow myself to take steps down. If I think I'm going to fall, I'm going to back off because I don't have falling experience up there. And I know it's not going to be fun for me. I'm just going to start getting into that habit loop of self-criticism. If I go up there and try to push myself to commit, it's going to end up just being a battle in my head about like, you should commit. Oh, you suck because you're not committing. Oh, like you're just a weak climber. It's like, I'm not willing to have that conversation with myself. I'm going to admit to myself that that's right now is a zone I'm not willing to commit to. I can back off for now. If later I want to do fall practice and extend my yes fall zone farther, I can do that. But my boundary is like, once that mental battle starts, once I start arguing with myself on the wall, I'm going to take a step down because I'm not, that's not what I'm up to in my climbing, right? That's an example of a boundary. Or I can set boundaries with myself around how I interact with my climbing days. Like I can go try a project and maybe I'm trying to have a better relationship with projecting. And as long as I'm able to like have fun, I'm laughing when I'm falling off, I'm like interacting well with the project. That's great. I'm like allowed to stay up there. But at the moment that I'm going to chuck my shoes across the crag and start like swearing at my belayer, I'm going to invite myself back down to the ground, right? Like I'm not going to be allowed to keep rock climbing because that's a boundary I'm going to set for myself. So there's pieces there that I work a lot with athletes to say, like their goals for a route aren't just sending, but it's sending and. Like I want to send this route and take the rest days that I need for my body. Or I'm going to send this route and I'm going to enjoy my days out with my climbing partner. And I think boundaries allow us to have that both and, where we're taking on big, scary goals and we're approaching them really intentionally and we're able to enjoy the whole process of it.
Mm. And do you think it's important that people are essentially doing some groundwork with these things? It's not something that you just do by turning up on a climbing day. This is something where you have, like, as you said, you have to be more intentional and do a little bit of prep work behind your climb days. You're going to get something out of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I do a lot of work with athletes to understand what it means to set boundaries and what it means to develop the awareness of our own body and mind so that we know when we're getting close to an edge. So I think a lot of it is developing an intuitive sense of knowing when we're in an appropriate learning space versus when we're in a space where we're getting unhealthy or where we're getting overwhelmed. And then I think it is like kind of understanding what your values are and what you want out of your climbing and how you can approach that more intentionally. So I think that like there's drills that I'll teach for really like the risk assessment process for a yes, no fall zone. I teach that to every climber, even if I have them for like a 4-hour clinic one time, like I'll teach them that process. And all of our trainers at the Warriors Way teach that process because I think it's so fundamental. And I think we continue to build on that and create nuance around it. So it's kind of when you were talking about that nuance earlier with like someone, we give someone a skill that feels really tangible and kind of like, here's step one, here's step two, here's step three, that I want someone to be able to have a framework for setting boundaries from day one. And then throughout a whole training journey, if they continue doing more mental training, it can become a lot more nuanced, but at least with the ability to make risk decisions about how we're going to commit on a rock climb, that is something that I think can be pretty easy to explain and fundamental for climbing.
Mm. And last thing I wanted to ask you to today in this chat, and I know that we've gone across so many different areas here, and you know, there's lots of things that people, you know, want to read up on, and I'll kind of get your details of where people can find more stuff out on this, you know, after they've finished listening. But would you mind sharing with everyone we talked about it? Actually, no, we've kind of touched upon it a few times now around kind of falling and fear of falling. I think it's a really common thing that people are challenged with in their climbing. Could you give people a few pointers or practices of things that they want to actually just be careful to avoid, actually, like you said really early on around, you don't really want to be taking massive whippers to deal with your fear of falling. It'd be good if you could, yeah, like just share a few things of like, you thought this is not always productive, even though you might see some people trying it or it seems intuitive to do it.
Totally. Oh, that's even a hard one to know where to start. But the guidelines that I'll give folks is, like, it goes back to that nervous system regulation piece, right? And this comes, there's all kinds of research that you can look into in the nervous system and what it means to be regulated, which means, like, when we're able to thrive or we're feeling resilient. But a lot of it comes down to these really simple cues of, do I know what I did during the fall? Like, do I actually know what I was doing with my body? Because so many, if you blacked out during the fall, whatever you did, like, not actually passed out, but, like, if you can't remember it, and that's really common, people will be like, oh yeah, I black out during a fall. It probably means you were in too high of a stressful situation. If you don't know if you exhaled, if you only exhaled because you were screaming at the top of your lungs, if your eyes were closed, if you're grabbing the rope, like, any of those are indicators that you were in a pretty high stress situation. I think trying to take the biggest fall possible to get it over with, that is one of the, that's the biggest trap I see, honestly. Anyone who's trying to, like, take the biggest fall to get it over with, you really, like, just kind of questioning that line of thought, right? Because it's like, you're actually, you're not getting it over with. This is going to be a part of your climbing. So you want those falls to be reasonable and appropriate for where you are right now. And even within incremental falling practice, what I really see people get caught up on are either trying to take steps up too quickly. Like, they get the process. They're like, yeah, I should be incremental. I should take one step at a time. But then they literally, like, get on the wall and they take a fall, and then they take a step up and take a fall, and then they take a step up and take a fall. And it does the same thing where it pushes them outside of that comfort zone too quickly. And then the other really common one that I see with incremental falling is that people try and take too many falls at a time, right? So I like to think of, what is a reasonable dose of falling for your time on the wall? And trying to, the same way you would with strength training, it's like, you're not necessarily going to get more out of a session by trying to do, like, 30 reps on a bench press rather than 5 really quality ones, right? Like, it's a totally different stimulus, first of all, but, like, at a certain point, like, maybe trying to do hypertrophy or doing more reps, that's fine. But, like, at a certain point, you're just doing too many reps in a row. You're just going to get fatigued. Your form's going to get really poor, and you're not getting any gains out of it. And that's what I see during falling practice, is people get the whole process right. Like, they understand the small steps, they're paying attention to breathing, eyes, body, and they just stay up there for half an hour or an hour. And they end up getting exhausted. And then they think of falling as this thing that, like, they're like, well, I can't do it today because I don't have an hour to set aside for it. Right. So I often say, if you can set aside time for 3 falls, maybe 5 falls, if you're, like, really into it and you really want to practice during a warm up, that can be enough for the day. Right. And then maybe you fall when you're projecting, or maybe you don't. Right? Maybe that's not where you are yet in your climbing. And that comes back to the patience piece. Like, people see that and they're like, 3 falls, right? Like, that's nothing. How am I ever going to get over my fear? Right? But if you practice 3 falls and you climb twice a week and you do that for a month, you've taken a lot more falls probably than you would in your one day of falling practice that you set aside. So I think really helping people understand that, like, this is just a technique that we're bringing into our climbing. We want it to be a part of our climbing, and we want to do it in an intentional way, but also not overwhelm ourselves. Those are some of the pitfalls that I tend to see. And I just reminding people, we're not in a rush to fix ourselves, right? Like, we're not broken fallers. We just need some more skill.
That was great. Thank you very much for those of you there. I'm sure that people would have found those really useful, and I know that this is a big topic for a lot of people, and they are interested in working out their own approach and how they can kind of take this aspect of their climbing and their performance or their journey or their enjoyment in climbing further, where is the best place for them to kind of go, would you say, to find out more? And I asked this specifically in respect to yourself, if they want to do any work with you, or any other general resources that you think are great for this area.
Yeah. The best way to connect with me and my coaching is through the Warriors Way website. We have a page that lists all of our training options. So we have in-person programs, and then we also do remote coaching. We have a really cool group course that I wrote and launched this year that is a hybrid learning course. So you do work online, and then there's a synchronous portion where you're in small groups with other people who are studying the same material as you. And I've been floored by the groups that I've gotten a chance to lead with those. And I just love the people that have come and learned in that space. So that's a really powerful thing to check out. Those are our free mind groups. And then I also do one-on-one coaching, and that's on the website as well. I share a lot of personal content about my climbing and how mental training influences my climbing, mostly through Instagram is the best place to find me. And it's just my name, Laura Sabrin, is my Instagram handle. So you're welcome to look there. We also have a Warriors Way Instagram that we put pictures from our clinics and information about our upcoming trainings. And if you're interested in learning more specifically about mental training, we actually have a resource on our website for a lot of the books that we've used and the research papers that we've used to develop the material. So a lot of people want to dig deeper after they learn about this and see what some of those sources are. And I love that curiosity. And so if people are interested in learning more about the ways that we're drawing mental training, our mental training curriculum from mental performance research, and also the research that's being done in the field of mental health and how that influences us as athletes, you can go on the website and look at that resource list and always reach out to me with questions, or I love geeking out about this stuff. So I'm excited when people reach out.
Awesome. We'll put the links in the show notes, so people can kind of find those easily as well. And, you know, as Laura said, get in contact with them to, you know, go further if you want, you have direct questions, etc. And I thoroughly recommend Laura's post on Instagram in particular. I always think that stuff's really great when you have like real life, real world examples, but then also someone explaining their process and what they're thinking around them. And I love stuff like that. I think that's one of the things that I like about social media, is that it's, you know, it's real. Someone say there's lots of fake stuff in there and it's not always real, but there are also some really good accounts like Laura's as well. I hope everyone today has enjoyed listening. I've certainly loved doing this interview and chatting to Laura again. And thanks for joining me on this one, Laura. And I'm sure we'll probably be in person next time we catch up.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tom. It really meant a lot to talk with you today.
Yeah, catch you soon.